Hello, and thank you for joining for another episode of Turkey Book Talk. I'm William Armstrong here in Istanbul. In this podcast, we hear from authors of newly released books on Turkey and the region. Give our Facebook page a like and or follow the Twitter account at Turkey Book Talk. There are show notes and links at armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com. And please do rate or review the podcast wherever you listen to it, which really does help more people find it. Remember, if you haven't already, do consider signing up to become a Turkey Book Talk member for exclusive extras and help us keep going. Joining our growing list of signed up members gets you transcripts in both English and Turkish of every interview published on Turkey Book Talk via email as soon as the episode is published. You also get transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive, which so far amounts to over 80 conversations and which includes a number of extra interviews not previously published on the podcast. Members also get access to an exclusive discount deal, a whopping 35% off the cover price of books published in IB Taurus's extensive Turkey and Ottoman history category. IB Taurus, which is now part of Bloomsbury, has well over 400 books in its Turkey and Ottoman history series, including both academic and general interest titles, and Turkey Book Talk members receive a special code for a 35% discount on books in that series, including physical books, pre-orders, and ebooks. Last but not least, members also receive an archive of 231 book reviews written by myself, covering various categories including Turkish and international fiction and poetry, history, politics, journalism, the Middle East and Europe. The archive was written over the course of 5 years and was previously available online, but nowadays a Turkey Book Talk membership is the only way to access it. To become a member, all you have to do is pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. New episodes go out every 2 weeks, so the monthly membership price is no more than $6. Of course, if you're feeling particularly generous and want to pledge more, then you'll certainly be more than welcome, but so long as you pledge $3 or above per episode, membership is entirely at your own discretion. Members only get charged when a new episode is published, so there are no prior commitments or strings attached. You'll be free to sign off whenever you want. But now let's get on with our latest episode, in which we welcome Ceren Lord. She's a British Academy postdoctoral research fellow at Oxford University's School of Global and Area Studies, and the author of Religious Politics in Turkey, From the Birth of the Republic to the AKP, which is published by Cambridge University Press. The book challenges the popular binary understanding of modern Turkish history, in which the current AK Party government of Recep Tayyip Erdogan represents an authentic, religious, bottom-up social reaction against a monolithic secular state that has long oppressed it. The reality, as Ceren Lord shows in the book, is much more complicated, with religion and religious interest groups vying for influence within the state, just like many other groups, for many decades, arguably since the declaration of the Republic. We get into some of the practical details about how that manifested itself a bit later, but I started by asking Ceren Lord to talk about what triggered her interest in this subject and why write the book at this point.
You're talking about sort of the master, what Deniz Kandioti describes as sort of master narrative of Turkish politics or Turkish studies, which is this very binary approach of looking at the eternal, in a sense, the eternal struggle between sort of the so-called Kemalist state versus a Muslim or religious or pious society. And it was really just the observation that, you know, when you actually look at the practices of the state, what you see on the ground, it's obviously far more complicated. So even with the coup, the recent coup attempt, you know, all these revelations of the Glenist infiltration of the state the last 30 years, you know, how do you fit that into the sort of narrative of a Kemalist, highly secular state, for example, if you've had this sort of infiltration for the last, at least for the last 30 years? So just try to break down some of these narratives, because they really don't, increasingly do not at all reflect what's happening on the ground. It's just become a sort of a narrative without any attempt to prove these dynamics. So it's just assumed they're the sort of top-down modernization project. The state is highly monolithic, very sort of unitary, and often conflated with the military. And we've seen, especially sort of in recent years, some more revisionist historical literature that have challenged these sort of understandings, even in the early the single party years, including things like the imposition of, you know, dress codes and so on. So there is sort of an increasing challenge to the early sort of historiography and early historical portrayals of this top-down modernization that wasn't challenged at all from the ground or more negotiated by actors at the time.
So essentially, sort of mobilization of Islamist identity was driven, or has been driven, not just from the bottom up, but actually from within the state and top down. So it repudiates this narrative that you've got these two monolithic things. You've got the state and the society, and one is acting on the other. And, you know, that's how you read modern Turkish history.
Yes, exactly. So the whole, for years, AKP project was associated with democratization because there was a sort of perception that Islamism and the AKP's rise was essentially sort of the reaction against the secular authoritarian state by a Muslim society, as if Islamist politics is the only authentic representation of, again, nominally Muslim, you know, sort of majority country, as almost a sort of inevitable process of democratization. And again, really resting on this master narrative that there is a sort of clash that is inherent to Turkish politics between the secular Kemalist elite and the traditional Muslim society, or periphery versus center. It had various formulations, but essentially the same. There has been more sort of nuanced versions of this. So this idea that there is a sort of continuity between the Ottoman Empire and the Republic in terms of control of religion by the state, but it's always about control of religion by the secular state and sort of suppression of the Muslim majority or the Muslim society. So then this feeds the sort of idea of victimhood of not just society, but specifically the idea of victimhood of Muslim or Islamist society only, and this sort of idea of instrumentalization of religion without looking at the fact that the actual state is a far more differentiated entity, as you can see from the role of the Diyanet. So looking at the Diyanet really was sort of trying to go past representations of the state as, you know, secular, Kemalist and so on, but looking at really just the practices. So what is the Diyanet doing? Well, it's actually a central faction within the state that has not only helped mobilize Islamist politics, but also has been a key actor in Islamization of Turkey over time.
I want to come on to the Diyanet a bit later. We published an episode a few months ago, actually, with Halil Karaveli about his book, which makes quite similar points to yours. And he kind of makes the point that, again, that rather than the state being this kind of monolithic actor, which is often assumed in commentary, it's always had many different groups within it sort of struggling for power. They've had various interests and political visions. And in fact, Islamic groups have been involved in the state really since the declaration of the Republic, and Islamist groups have been involved in parts of the state and various ministries pretty much since the 50s, 60s and 70s, you know, and it gives a much more nuanced view of the trajectory of contemporary Turkey, really.
Yes, exactly. I mean, it's quite amazing. I remember when I first proposed this book to the publishers, and I was saying I want to present a sort of alternative way of looking at the state, and in that way also sort of the rise of Islamist politics. And I remember sort of getting the feedback that it's amazing how much this sort of a lot of Turkish scholarship revolves around this one paradigm of this master narrative. And actually, it's quite counterintuitive. There's nothing really that's spectacular about saying the state is more differentiated and has many different factions. I mean, it's very obvious. But it's quite amazing. I've had such a reaction to just saying, oh, the Diyanet, as any bureaucracy, has played this sort of a different role to what, you know, you might think. Even that gets so much reaction. It's quite amazing. But it's nice that it's just sort of the paradigms falling apart, finally.
I suppose it's not just scholarship, is it, really? Because that master narrative is very powerful within Turkey itself. You know, it really does define how politics and how political parties and how the entire narrative of contemporary life actually goes about. Because really, it's the basis of the way that the AK Party presents itself based on this kind of opposition.
Yes, but it's also, I think it's also sort of wider, this perception is at least in terms of studies on secularism, of the state as a secular entity, and somehow sort of the glorification or this adoption of Islamist politics as authentic or as a sort of reaction to secular modernization is quite wide within the literature itself, outside of Turkey. So it's unsurprising in some ways, I guess, for AKP, of course, it serves the victimhood narrative. All they've done is they've just turned upside down the sort of official historiography that dominated before, or the modernization paradigm about how Turkey was modernizing, and there was going to result in withdrawal of religion, and they've just sort of turned it upside down to present a picture that sounds like it's just been about Islamist victimhood, essentially. But it's common to much of the literature.
I just wonder how you mentioned it a couple of times in the book, but how central to your argument is the fact that the demographics of the state from 1923, the founding of the Republic, were really defined religiously. So despite the secular worldview of many of the early Kemalist cadres, they were very explicit about wanting to fashion a nation out of the Muslim populations of Anatolia. Mm-hmm. And that, regardless of any ideology, that in fact set the course in a way or define the country in a particularly religious way that ended up developing in subsequent decades in ways that perhaps some of those early Republican modernizers couldn't foresee?
I think it was quite crucial. I think as I try to kind of explain various factors, the institutional frameworks and the majority-minority boundaries that were established, including ethnicization, emergence of religion as an ethnic marker in Ottoman Empire became quite key when we come to the Republic, including sort of the inclusion of the religious body within the state, but also the elevation of Muslim identity, essentially. And this is also, again, typical of the later nation-building projects, which, unlike the earlier constitution-making in various sort of European countries in which political systems, constitutions were written in a way to sort of check majority power or sort of, you know, liberal checks. In the Turkish case, sort of post-empire, it was more about constructing a majority nation. So all of these resulted in specific institutions and the elevation of the Sunni Muslim Turkish majority or construction of it, which then, as I tried to explain, resulted in not only this type of institutionalization, but which was key to having triggering path-dependent effects. So it was very hard to then shift these because these institutions then developed ways in which to protect the Sunni Muslim Turkish majority being the hegemonic power within this construct, as with the Diyanet, for example, or the role of Muslims within the economy, for example, of course, was encouraged, as various scholars have shown, to the detriment of any remaining non-Muslims, which is very clear in the archive material as well.
And there's an emphasis on the Diyanet in the book. A few weeks ago or a few months ago, we had an episode on the Diyanet as well, if people want to go back and have a listen to that. But just talk about why the Diyanet is significant, you know, describe what it is, why is it significant, and what role has it played in embedding religious identity within at the centre of the state, really?
The Diyanet is the central faction within the state that has pursued Islamization, which is then has been sort of very important for facilitating Islamist mobilization. It's really, to some extent, a continuation of the Ottoman ulema. So when the Diyanet was established in 1924, it absorbed the Ottoman Sunni ulema. And within the literature, it's been described essentially as an organization that was created by the secular Kemalist state to control religion. But in fact, or what I try to show in the book is that this continuance was important in the fact that it has been an important agent driving Islamization over time. So it's involved basically legally tasked with managing religious affairs in the country. So it sends sermons, it manages the mosques and appoints imams and religious functionaries.
And it's probably worth noting here that the resources of the Diyanet have actually been expanded after all, almost all military coups in the multi-party period. And that may come as a surprise, really, you know, the fact that the Diyanet's resources expanded after these interventions by what is supposedly a secular state.
Yes. I mean, as I said, in 1924, when it was established, it had a far more sort of narrow definition of implementation of all provisions concerning faith and worship. And then in 1960, they included moral guidance to the nation and enlightening society about religion. 1982, they had a key role in implementation of the sort of the Islamization program dubbed the Turkish Islamic Synthesis, which was very much like the current era. Diyanet was tasked with disseminating religious teachings and morality in all aspects of life. So from factories, hospitals, homes. Since the 90s, Diyanet has formalized this sort of understanding of services outside of the mosque, which is nothing new, but it was sort of more formalized within its own regulations in the 1990s. And in the AKP era, it has really had the opportunity, given the sort of overlap in interests with the AKP, to put some of these, you know, agendas in, to realize some of these agendas. So these have included sort of increasing activities outside the mosques, expanding activities in the hospitals and these various arenas, including the recent move for the mufti marriages, allowing Diyanet imams or muftis to conduct civil ceremonies. So that was also a key element of the Diyanet's agenda. Again, in the AKP era, Diyanet has been presented as sort of AKP's ideological tool, and perhaps policies that Diyanet has also negotiated or has been in its interest to do all of these things.
I suppose the argument against that really would be people would say that the Diyanet actually had a specific role or has had a specific role throughout the Republic, and that is to kind of control religion. So if you're more interested in the spread of religious belief or the promotion of religious belief, you would be sort of naturally against the Diyanet because it puts a kind of limit on your activities because it sort of monopolizes religious activity. And in that sense, it could be seen as an expression of a secular state because it prevents autonomous religious structures developing within a country. I mean, what would you say to that criticism?
Well, then we have to ask, who are these religious functionaries that work for the Diyanet? So it assumes a very strict separation between the ulema that work within the Diyanet and the Islamist movement and Islamist intellectuals and various tariqa orders. But in fact, of course, it's very fluid. You can just see that from, for example, the fact that they just fired some 3,000 plus workers from the Diyanet that have been accused of being ulemists, or the role of the Suleymanjin, which were tariqa order, which was very prominent in the Diyanet for many years until the sort of the rise of the Imam Hatib generation of Tahir al-Tikulaj, who was the Diyanet chief in the 1980s, and Hayreddin Karaman, who's often seen as Erdogan's fatwa authority. So one, there is this very fluid relationship, and two, existence of Diyanet caused a huge amount of resources to this Islamist project and policies of Islamization, as we're often debating the extent of the Diyanet's budget and its resources and its constant expansion, especially in recent years. So there's the resources and the Diyanet's negotiation, for example, of Turkish national identity, to the extent that they have resisted equal citizenship rights essentially to Alevi communities, the second largest faith group in Turkey after Sunni Muslims, by rejecting any possibility of state recognition of Alevi houses of worship called Cemevis. So they play a quite prominent role which goes beyond this narrow role accorded to it. So one, you really can't assume the sort of separation between the ulema and Islamists in this way. So I think that we have to sort of take into account a much more sort of fluid boundary between state and society as well.
Talk about the 1980 military coup, because it's the military intervention that more than others really proves how misguided or mistaken it is to view the military as, or the state as, this purely secular force. Yes. The coup was this basically a conservative nationalist coup. It sought to promote Turkish Islamic ideological synthesis, as you mentioned before, and that basically boosted support really for religious conservatism as a way to keep the country together and be a buffer against communism, essentially.
Yeah.
How does the 1980 coup fit into the picture here?
It was, of course, I mean, I think a lot of scholarship has also identified 1982 coup as an important turning point in terms of the greater promotion of the sort of idea of, you know, the Islamization in Turkey by the state. But again, it has often been understood as a strategy of the secular state to instrumentalize religion against the communist threat or the sort of the crushing of the left. But if you look at, for example, you know, the role that Aydın Laroca, the Hearth of the Enlightened, play, for example, Hayrettin Karaman, again, Islamist intellectual, and Erdogan's very close to Erdogan, you know, his role in Aydın Laroca, who actually wrote up this Turkish Islamic synthesis program and developed it. So Islamist, nationalist, conservative circles were very influential, and they were established in the 1970s, even before the 1980 coup. What I'm trying to say is that 1980 coup, of course, was important in the sort of greater overt Islamization program, in which certain factions of the state, the conservative Islamist nationalist factions of the state, became much more powerful. But these factions were there struggling with other factions, well, since the establishment of the Republic, but had already begun to become much more prominent since at least the 1940s. So 1980 was just a strengthening of these particular factions, as we saw with the propagation of the Turkish Islamic synthesis program developed by the Hearth of the Enlightened.
And it was really after, in the years after that coup, that the Islamist precursors of today's AKP really did plant their roots, essentially, on the kind of urban periphery. And these networks provided services for many new urban migrant communities, and they sort of helped with various things like, electricity, food, mm-hmm. housing. And that gave them a base of support, really, to build on that still really endures today. So in that sense, there was indeed a bottom-up thing from society that was the expression of Islamic values. But it's important to mention that that couldn't have happened really without the space first being opened up by the state after the coup, really. Specifically, we had these liberal economic reforms and the kind of crushing of leftist groups by the authorities. And in fact, those groups often provided similar services in the years before the coup, but because they were crushed by the authorities afterwards, they couldn't do it anymore. And it opened up this big space for somebody else to step in to the void. And that's what a lot of Islamically motivated groups did. And they really did provide the base for the RefUp, the welfare party. And that's why their first electoral successes were in, municipalities in the late 80s or early 90s. So, I mean, would you say that's a fair reading of what happened? I mean, the state sort of helping to create the vacuum that Islamist networks stepped into after 1980?
Yes, I do not in any way deny that these bottom-up processes of Islamist mobilization didn't happen and that they were only just from the top. But what I'm suggesting is that there was a much more fluid process in which, yes, spaces did open up increasingly after 1980 coup. They were opened up before, but increasingly so after 1980 coup, partly through the liberalization of the economy and the proliferation supported by the state of Islamic charities and associations, basically to compensate for the so-called withdrawal of the state away from welfare provision, as we saw in various other countries in the Middle East also, and how the Islamist organizations were then able to take up these spaces to build up a base. That's a completely accurate presentation. But I'm just suggesting that the institutional makeup was very important in influencing type of strategies and the types of mobilizations that came about.
And bringing the situation forward to today, there's a kind of Islamic nationalism that seems completely entrenched, really, at the top of the state and all its offices under Erdogan. Do you think things are destined to continue down the same path now or what? A lot of people are talking about how control over the state is overseen by Erdogan, but it's also increasingly a site of struggle between various sort of patronage interest groups and tariqats. And you referred to this a bit at the end of the book. Just wonder if you could expand on that a little bit.
This is the hardest question, considering that it seems to be every day the whole situation just seems to defy any explanation. But there is the sense that sort of the fiefdoms with different ministries, or for all we can see, at least from the news, is this fiefdoms of ministries being controlled by different tariqa orders and struggles within the Islamist community itself, with news of an impending crackdown on the Suleymanjah, which would have been unconceivable in sort of previous periods, even by the military. So there are sort of sites of struggle within parts of the state and inside the Diyanet too, but the regime has gone through a transformation with the constitutional changes, and increasingly power is highly centralized under the presidential office. It's very hard to see how these structures can be easily changed in the future. It just seems that the direction is further centralization and perhaps further instability, because institutions are being so, not only becoming increasing sites of struggle, but also becoming sort of emptied out of any, there's no really functioning state left in that sense.
And I wonder also what you make of this. I don't know if you've been following, but there's been quite an interesting sort of debate that's been rumbling on. It spikes up every now and then, and it's just seen one of those spikes. There was this social trends report that was just published by Conda, which is like this one of the research companies here, and it tracks social attitudes, and basically it found a small but still fairly striking tendency towards a more open and, let's say, liberal and actually less religious worldview among amongst respondents in its survey. And this is, it kind of prompted a flurry of commentary, perhaps more than it actually deserves. But there's been other reports as well. There's been other surveys that have actually found the same thing. And, you know, whenever these reports come out, there's always this kind of commentary and people are commenting on the paradox, really, that despite the fact that there is this religious conservative government that's very aggressively trying to shape society in its own image, actually society sort of has its own dynamics as well. I would just wonder, I mean, the book is largely focused really on state institutions and how they affect or shape society. But what do you make of this sort of recent paradoxical trend, really? What do you think that expresses?
It's difficult to say whether this, you know, how strong this tendency is. I've obviously not done any research on it myself. And, you know, it's sort of very limited amount of information that we have on it. But I notice that within the pro-government circles and Islamist circles, there is this increasing debate of sort of youth perhaps veering away from the religion. I guess my focus has been much more on the fact that there is this immense amount of Islamization of the education sector, which it has an effect. I mean, it's seen as a sort of major threat, for example, by the Alevi community and various other communities, because it's obviously increasingly hard to get any secular education in which they're not being taught sort of Sunni Islam religious propaganda, essentially. It's difficult for me to say how strong this tendency is, but if you look at it historically, when you've had sort of these sort of major educational changes, I would say it's probably quite unlikely for it to be enough to overturn the tide of this extreme Islamization of the education system that we're seeing in recent years. But I mean, that's a quite pessimistic view.
Yeah, I don't know myself. I mean, I just wonders. I think that's actually getting to the core of people always refer to the education system. And it's always interesting how I remember in 2015, after the June election, then seems like another world now. But there were the coalition negotiations between the AKP and the CHP, actually. And people were talking about like what ministries each party would control. And everybody was obsessed with taking the education ministry because people saw it as being this sort of foundational ministry that we would be able to shape future generations and complete and shape the country in the coming years. That struck me at the time as being, it expressed something that I think is kind of shared across the political spectrum. It's like, if you control the state, you control society, and, you know, you can sort of mold it in your own way. And, you know, that's why the education system has always had this kind of totemic importance in Turkey, really. People have always wanted to control it.
That's exactly, I mean, you know, when the Republic was established and they had sort of unification of education, that was precisely the reasoning behind it, that if you have two, you know, they have the madrasas and then you have the secular education, it results in the sort of duality of the nation in terms of thinking, as they said was what characterized the sort of the late Ottoman era. So they went for this unification of education, but then, of course, you have the proliferation and emergence of the Imam Hatip schools from the 1950s. And the Imam Hatip schools are really quite crucial. Again, the generation that has taken hold in Diyanet, especially in the higher ranks, is precisely this group of people like Hayreddin Karaman, again, Tahir Atakulaj, the former head of the Diyanet. This generation, this group that they formed of Imam Hatip graduates in the 60s, they saw Imam Hatip schools as a way in which to create a pious generation, which of course sounds very familiar to what we heard with the golden generation plans of the Gulenists. So Imam Hatip schools, even though they were sort of course administered and run by the state, who were teaching these schools? Of course, some of the former madrasa teachers, some famous Islamists. So you have this massive national network, parallel education system being taught by members of the ulema and Islamist circles. And of course, Imam Hatip's are often described by Islamists as, you know, Erdogan often talks about how, you know, Imam Hatip school made him who he is. So this link between Imam Hatip schools and the rise of the Islamist movement is something that has been spoken about. So education is quite crucial in how these different factions within the state have used it to essentially shape or try to shape different generations, let's say.
I wonder, what would you say to people, you know, there's a kind of rejection that I think is broadly correct of this master narrative of the state and the society and this idea that the secular state is, you know, monolithic. But there are also episodes in recent memory, really. You know, what would you say to somebody who said, well, I wasn't allowed to wear a headscarf at university, or I wasn't allowed to wear a headscarf to work because I worked in a ministry, or I worked as a lawyer, or, you know, I was removed from my job after the 1997 so-called postmodern coup. I mean, were they just elements within the state battling out and that coup was carried out by one group of them? Or, you know, was it something a bit more dominant within the state that people have or had legitimate grievances against? I mean, what would you say to that critique?
Of course, that those grievances are very real. The banning of the headscarf was a real victimization in that sense of these women. But yes, there were different factions within the state. And the story, again, is far more complicated because, of course, at the same time as that happening, there was the proliferation of other types of Islamist activities very supported by the state. So I just don't think it's a very straightforward story of, you know, Islamist reaction, bottom-up reaction to secular state. And there's been no sort of negotiation between. And you can see that, for example, that the state was allowing Gulenist schools to proliferate at the time, building Imam Hatib schools in and taking apparently some 5,000 kids from Dersim or Tunjali to send them to Imam Hatib schools for Islamization. These other things were happening at the same time, so that it's very hard to then describe it as a sort of just very easy sort of confrontation or in a sort of a very binary way.
That was Jeren Lord. Many thanks to her. Head over to armstrongwilliam.wordpress.com to find a link to the episode we mentioned earlier, Halil Karaveli, on A History of Authoritarianism in Modern Turkey. We published that episode last August, and it touches on some of the same issues as Jeren's book. Don't forget to consider signing up as a Turkey Book Talk member if you enjoy the podcast and want to help support it. Membership gets you access to that special 35% discount on Turkey Ottoman history books published by IB Taurus and Bloomsbury. Transcripts in English and Turkish of every interview as it's published. Transcripts of the entire Turkey Book Talk archive of over 80 conversations so far, and access to an archive of 231 book reviews written by me covering Turkish history and politics, literature and various other things. To become a member and get all that, just pledge a minimum of $3 per episode via Turkey Book Talk's official Patreon account. Also, do please rate or review Turkey Book Talk on iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use. You can follow via Twitter or like the Facebook page to stay fully updated with new episodes, and you can send any recommendations, feedback or abuse to williamjohnarmstrong@gmail.com. But until the next episode of Turkey Book Talk in a couple of weeks, thank you very much for listening.